Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology, based right here out of Santa Barbara. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. Hey everyone, welcome back to That Anthro Podcast. I'm really, really happy to be launching season two of the podcast. I learned so much during my first year of recording episodes, you know, from July 2020 to June 2021. And then I took my summer to, you know, do some summer things. I did took a couple trips, but also what I did this summer was recorded all of the episodes for the fall. So I have about 10 episodes ready to be put out. And the main reason that I did that is because I am actually in quite a hectic time of my life. I'm applying to graduate programs in forensic anthropology and bioarchaeology currently, which anyone who's applied to graduate school knows there's quite a bit of effort that goes into that. I'm also trying to apply to various grants, presenting my research at conferences, and, you know, just really doing as much as I can my senior year. So I'm really excited for all of the people that we have coming up in season two. I think you guys are really, really going to enjoy listening to them. I was kind of blown away after every single interview. They all kind of topped each other. And there wasn't an intro in last week's podcast because truly until I posted it, I utterly forgot to record an introduction. So I just wanted to say hello to everyone, let you know that starting in January, I will also be creating another form of the podcast that'll be subscription-based. So if you, because it's a bit more niche, but it's something that I'm really interested in doing. And then Anchor started doing subscriptions. So it'll be subscription based if you're interested in listening. It's going to be called Tea and Bones. And we're going to go over osteology, basically like a bone an episode, maybe multiple, learn fun facts about them, learn generally about the bone, how they function in the body. Maybe perhaps paleopathological lesions that may appear on it or any other abnormalities that the bone may have, which I think will be really fun. And yeah, but I know that that won't be necessarily interesting for everyone. So like I said, it'll be subscription based. I had a lovely summer. I hope that you all did as well. And if you're a teacher, a student, or a professional alike, I hope that you were able to stay healthy and safe and are entering this fall feeling refreshed after hopefully a rejuvenating summer. And ultimately, I would like to say the hugest thank you to everyone for supporting. I'd like to thank the American Anthropological Association for partnering with me. I'm really, really thankful to be partners with them. They have a library of amazing podcasts. The link's always in the description if you want to check out some other podcasts that are sponsored by the AAA, because I would highly recommend it. They're all incredible. And just thank you to all the new listeners. I know we got a lot of new listeners over the summer, which was interesting considering I wasn't posting episodes, but I'm appreciative nonetheless. The next thing that I just want to say is that I am selling podcast stickers. That's just the cover art on a sticker on redbubble.com. So I actually don't fulfill the orders Redbubble does, which is really amazing. It also means that I don't have to have like a stock at any time. It also means that all of your checkout information is completely private through Redbubble. It's not like I'm addressing each envelope. And, you know, I think it's kind of fun. We had a listener, Chelsea, who put it on her scooter, the sticker. And honestly, I think that's the coolest place I've seen a sticker yet. I need to put one on my car now that I think about it. 100%. Right after I'm done recording this, I'm going to go put one on my car. But yeah, it's really fun to have those available now because a couple people have been asking. Oh, there's also magnets on the Redbubble. There's some magnets if you'd like as well. I was going to get one for myself. Just kind of fun little things, you know. I don't necessarily feel the need to make like merch, like sweaters or shirts. I don't really think anyone would want that. But nonetheless, thank you all so much for supporting the podcast. It means the world.
if you're interested in coming on for an episode, feel free to email me. Or if you have someone that you think would be great, someone you've been thinking of, oh, I am a fan of their writing, I would really like to see them on the podcast. I'm always looking for ideas and of just any general ideas about the podcast. I'm always open to them. Also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. I post a lot of behind the scenes content, and honestly, I put a lot of time and effort into the social media, less so on Twitter. We're at That Anthropod on Twitter and at That Anthropod Cast on Instagram. And those are always listed in the descriptions below. So without further ado, let's get into the episode with Katie. Katie Sieber is someone who I felt so lucky to get to interview. She's friends with Amy Anderson, and we all know anyone that's friends with Amy, automatically I was going to love interviewing. But I felt like Katie had some extremely important points to share with all of us and really is an expert communicator in the way that she gets them across. I also am really thankful for our guests who are very vulnerable and share quite a bit of themselves with the podcast. It really helps us learn even more about them, and Katie was definitely one of those guests. Now, the one thing that I do want to say about Katie's episode, and this just happens, this is technology. It's not on Katie. It's not necessarily even on me, but Katie's audio is quite a bit quieter than mine. I'm not sure if my microphone was turned up lower. If mine was turned up higher, hers was turned down lower, whatever. So I would not recommend listening to this episode with headphones in, only because every time I speak, it's like 10 times louder than what Katie's saying. And I'd like to avoid blasting any of you in your ears with your headphones. So potentially it's still an incredible episode and you should definitely listen. I just would avoid headphones or be prepared that every time that I speak, I'm going to come through your headphones at 10 times louder volume than Katie. And I apologize for that. I try my very best with the technology, but you don't really know how something's recording until afterwards. And then afterwards you're like stuck with the audio you have. So it does not take anything away from Katie's incredible life journey or her podcast episode, but just a little PSA for you all. And finally, into the episode with Katie Sieber. Oh, also, I should have clarified because I have, I'm Gabriella and Gabby. Are you all right going by Katie on the podcast?
I am. That's my preferred. I only publish with my whole name because there is like a lot of Katie Siebers, which is weird.
Yeah, I understand that. I definitely have the whole, I just try to do my full name for like professional stuff and like to sign off emails and like to do on papers, but I go by Gabby just all the time. So, but I always like to check because some people have really strong feelings about the names that they like to go by. So
that is true.
Yeah. All right. So Katie, let's start off. I'm just curious before we dive into the details of the work you're doing, how you initially got interested in the field of archaeology, what drew you to study it in your graduate and college studies, and, let's just start there.
That's a great question, and it's a really common one because I am a public archaeologist, and I feel like it's always a little bit surprising, but in reality, I really have always wanted to be an archaeologist. So nobody in my family remembers how it happened or when it happened, but by the time I was 4, I had identified it as the thing I wanted to do. My mom always tells a story about I had a little fishing tackle box with paintbrushes in it, and I would go outside and dust off the tree roots because I was trying to do archaeology. I think I probably saw it in a PBS special or something.
Yeah.
As a child, I spent a lot of time learning about it. I got kids archaeology magazines, and I just knew that was what I was going to do. But I had obviously a very simplistic understanding of what archaeology was. I just understood to me that the past held the keys for a lot of things in my own life and my family's lives and my community. That I grew up in a very small town in rural West Virginia, and I was very close with my father's family that is from a small town in way upstate New York, near Ottawa. So the past was just something that almost haunted me as a kid. I just had so many questions about who were my ancestors and what were they doing and how did they live and how did that shape who I was? And it, as I got older, realized it really did. It had serious talons sunk into my family. So even in high school, I remember knowing and acknowledging that I needed to work with the past because it was important in a way that was sort of weirdly maniacal for a 16-year-old. I was just really drawn to it. So I was at the end of my high school career, and my father is a botanist and a biologist. He called his sister, who lives in Potsdam, New York, and said, "Katie is still on about this archaeology thing, and I just don't know what to do. I don't know where to send her. She's got to go to college." And he's a professor at a very small school in West Virginia, and he's the only one in his whole family that had ever been to college. And my wonderful aunt said, "You know, that's so crazy. My best friend from bowling's husband is an archaeologist who teaches at Potsdam State." So my dad essentially called this other man who was the husband of my aunt's best friend and said, "I have a weird daughter who is obsessed with archaeology, and I heard you're an archaeologist." And his name is Dr. Steve Marcusi. And he said, "I am. If she's into it, we should test it before she goes to college, though, in case she doesn't like it, because a lot of people do that."
Yeah.
So they schemed and made a plan. And so I went to field school 2.5 weeks after high school graduation, at a field school in Montpelier, James Madison's house in Orange, Virginia. I was 18. I'd never been anywhere, really. And my field school was obviously college students. And that field school, the point was looking for a fence line. Not fun.
No.
And it was like 100 degrees in the mountains of rural Virginia. And I loved it so much. And at the end of it, Dr. Marcus, he was like, "If you liked that,
yeah,
then you might be right."
I just gave a talk on applied anthropology for Anth 2, and about how I podcast and different things, you know. And I was just saying how I've really learned through field school that while if it's a project I'm super passionate about or an excavation I really want to do in a, you know, first in a cemetery or like for human remains, I will go out in the field and I will be a happy camper. The time will pass quickly. But I do not live for field work. And I go, but there are some people who do. And if you realize that, There are, you know, so many paths for you. There's all these things you can do if that's what you live for. And you have the right temperament, you know, if you have the temperament to stick with that and do that really intricate field work, because it is, if you're looking for a fence line, like there's so much that's going into it that ends up just being like moving dirt. If you can, you know, stick that out,
Sorry, I was going to
say. No, go ahead.
The funniest part of what you said is like, that is the only thing that happened. We just moved dirt and we found like 2 nails. And much later in the history of my life, I was teaching a field school in northeastern Pennsylvania. This would have been like 2017. And very quickly we realized there wasn't a site where we thought there was. And I spent the whole field school, you know, really teaching these young folks about how incredible it was that we were doing this work, and, you know, the nails we were finding were important, and the like slag stains, and the fact that we didn't find what we were looking for was great. It was a terrible sight and I hated it. But they left their field school being so amped, and then they all graduated and got jobs. Almost all of them stayed that were anthro graduates. A lot of them are still working in archaeology now, which is incredible. And they were all like, "You tricked me." That wasn't fun at all. And I was like, "I know." Sorry.
Hey, if you can, you know, like I said, if you can get in the mindset that everything you do in archaeology is important, every artifact you find, every piece of dirt that you move, like, means something. I mean, even just like the, you know, your first archaeo class, you get introduced to the concept of stratigraphy and, you know, the things on the bottom are older than the things on the top. But then when you actually start digging into the ground, like my first archaeological site for my field school, I literally walked on and was like, is this fake? Like, this just doesn't look real. Like, there's just like this much of the ground, the, you know, basilica like sticking out of the ground, and we're gonna like dig more around it. Like, what, that came out of the ground? You know, the actual like seeing how you go deep and deeper and find things is just crazy fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it still is, you know, like I'm 30. Oh my gosh, 32. So all these years later, some little baby 18-year-old, I'm still into stratigraphy in a very weird way.
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing to appreciate.
It is. One part of your question was, how has my perception of that changed since I was a baby archaeologist? And I think Potsdam State, or SUNY Potsdam, has an incredible archaeology program. Any person who's young, who's listening, who might listen and is interested in pursuing a degree in archaeology, I 100% say SUNY Potsdam. Their anthropology department is unparalleled, and I just lucked into like this gem.
Just to ask, do they have a graduate program as well for any? No,
okay. Not. It's one of, I don't remember how many SUNY schools there are, but it's a small liberal arts school. I think there's 5,000 people. It was the perfect size for me. But the anthropology department, because they don't have grad students, means they can put all of their attention into undergraduates. And that is best case scenario for any person who wants to get a undergraduate degree that is heavy in something that you need training. Archaeology needs lab work, that it needs hands-on. Mm-hmm. You need a place where there's not grad students sucking up your resources. And so this department was truly incredible. They saved my life in many ways, for real, but they also trained me really, really well. I got trained before even leaving that archaeology is about justice, and that archaeology can handle big, big problems that we have societally. And that's rare. But yes, my perception when I was there changed when I went in. You know, I was so excited about doing archaeology, and I was interested in things like the French and Indian War, and I was very interested in the colonial period. And that was like, you know, a kid's fascination. But through my classes and my experiences and working in the field in the lab, and especially taking other things around it, like I took a Native American literature course, I took like Indigenous Peoples of New York State, I was sort of exposed to the reality that anthropology started as rich people collecting things about other people because it was cool for them or fun, or they thought it was important, and that was not a great history, and so we could do better, and it was our choice to do better. And so I quickly realized, you know, by the time I was a senior, that I could take historical archaeology and wield it as a tool to address things. My advisor, her name is Dr. Hadley Cruzic-Aaron, and she had done several projects while I was there and before, using archaeology to talk about injustice, or she's focused on, we worked on the John Brown site in New York State, just using it for something beyond interest. And so it massively changed just in undergraduate. And then I left undergraduate and I worked in CRM for quite a few years in the South. And I've worked for horrific companies, and I've worked for incredible companies, and I've worked for medium companies. And that just sort of your lot as a field tech. And over time, I realized that the burden is literally on us to make archaeology what we want. So,
and to make it equitable.
Yeah, my trajectory started out pretty radical for an archaeologist. Not everyone gets to have that level of like radical injustice focused training, but it's only sort of like spiraled more in the other direction as I've gone, as I've gotten older.
Well, I definitely want to, before we end the episode, get some of your tips for CRM archaeology, because especially since you said you've worked at so many companies, I have some friends that I know are listeners that are really interested in the next year, year and a half going into CRM, you know, post undergrad graduation. And I'm sure some of our other listeners as well. But I'm really curious because, like you said, you did take time off between your bachelor's and your PhD. Well, so lots of PhD programs, you get your master's in conjunction with the PhD. So she also has her master's from this program, but was also in New York. And I was curious if that was kind of a deliberate decision, or just, you know, where you ended up getting in. Sometimes decisions, they come down to that, where you get money as well. But I thought maybe it had to do with you just loving the area, or, you know, a specific like, just part of New York.
Good question, and I was impressed by it. So the perchance nature of my first SUNY school was, it was also really about family. My dad is from New York, and my Aunt Renee, shout out to you, still lives in Canton, New York, which is like a tiny, truly tiny town in upstate New York. And I had spent my whole life summering there. My dad would take us up and we'd go there. And for me, SUNY Potsdam was a place that I found archaeology, but also my family. That, you know, there's like, my cousins were living in the area, and I was able to hang out with them and just experience that side of rural America, because I lived in a different part of rural America, right? Mm-hmm. But Potsdam was such a good experience in that once I left and I started working with other field techs my age at other companies, especially in the South, I had no idea how good my education was until I went there. And I'm not here to poo-poo other places, but I learned theory my senior year in undergrad. Our closing course was theory, and that would have been 2011. And when I got to my first CRM job was in Meridian, Mississippi, and a lot of the folks there had gone to Southern schools, and they were doing a very different style of archaeology there. And I don't think it's because they're backward or it was wrong as much as it was a conscious choice, right? There's people, a lot of the professors in Southern schools at the time were teaching things that were theoretically quite different. And had also not really, especially because the big, big schools like Alabama, Mississippi State, Ole Miss, LSU, their undergraduate students are cattle compared to their graduate students, right? And so they just hadn't gotten.
Yeah, the experience.
Or, yes, exactly. Or the reality of what we were doing. Because I saw my work as vital. Like, I was like, this is a vital job, because I believe that our nation and our cultures and the communities that live here are literally plagued by issues stemming from the past, right? Mm-hmm. And my job as part of that as an archaeologist is to help root that out. And I was on these massive sites that were incredible, you know, these huge historical Choctaw sites that were going to be underneath a massive retention pond for a coal plant, and we would be digging them out. And I would just think about, you know, we are very close to the Choctaw Reservation. Why are they not here? Why do I not see them? When I speak to my coworkers, why do they make fun of the Choctaw? Mm-hmm. And I speak to them and ask them about, like, why aren't the Choctaw here? Everyone makes it out to be like they don't care. Well, that couldn't be true. It couldn't be true. It was seemed like a lame excuse. And I had been to school that told me that, like, it wasn't true, right? And my mm-hmm. bosses are saying, they don't care. You know, I moved to another massive site. It was a cool lithic site in Arkansas, and it was about to be a highway, and we were doing mitigation. I worked there for a very long time, and some of the most amazing archaeology happened there, right? It had been a lithic production site, so a place where people had been making tools for thousands of years. But it was in Northwest Arkansas, and there probably was, in levels much higher than me, I was a peon, some contact with, you know, descendant tribes. I'm sure there may or may not have been Section 106. It was DOT, so I assume there might be, but there was no tribal monitors. There was nobody on the ground. And I was there for like 8 or 9 months seeing these incredible things and knowing they're going to go into boxes.
Yeah.
Never going to be seen by Indigenous people from the area. And I would ask my bosses about like what tribes or nations these are associated with. And there was just like this absolute detachment, right? They'd be like Mississippian. And I was like, that's a type of artifacts. What people?
Mm-hmm.
And I could never get an answer. And so I didn't know if I was stupid because I didn't fundamentally understand it, or there was something slightly wrong. So
there was something slightly wrong.
Yeah. When I went to grad school, I was like, first of all, I decided to go to grad school mostly because I needed dental care. And I wanted to be a crew chief. I didn't want to be anything more than that. I was just like, I can do better. But I took it seriously, and I spent like 7 months literally on this slog to find a person, because I knew, because my dad's a professor, that your advisor is going to make or break it, right? Mm-hmm. So I essentially went out and interviewed people. But before that, I looked for anyone that was doing something that resembled community engagement. And I didn't have the words for it yet. I learned those in grad school, that I was looking for someone who worked with community and heritage archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
I could not find a single one in the Southeast. I looked at all these different schools, and likely it was, you know, because their internet profiles weren't updated, right?
Yeah.
It is what it is. But looking for grad schools, you're reading these professors' bios and you're like, is this person doing what I'm doing?
Yeah. I'm going through that right now. So I really relate. I understand you.
Yeah. And so I went through, and the only people I could find were in the Northeast. And I applied to work with Steve Silliman at UMass Boston. I applied to work with Siobhan Hart at SUNY Binghamton, Kurt Jordan at Cornell, and somebody at UConn that I don't remember because I didn't get in. But I did get into the other three schools, and they're all in the Northeast, because mm-hmm. that is who was teaching community engaged archaeology.
Yep.
And I chose Binghamton because they paid me.
Yep.
Because I was funded.
Those are the reasons why you go to a school for a PhD. But I think it's really great to break down that reality so that people understand when they're looking for schools, you know, like what the reality is for everyone. As I said, I'm going through the process myself, so I really just want to help people understand what, you know, what it's like.
Yeah, everyone can sell you a story, and unfortunately we live in capitalism. And so we have to be critical consumers and set our own boundaries about what's acceptable for us. And that's hard when you're looking at your career, because especially in anthropology, a lot of us are dreamers and we have these huge goals, and that's some of the best parts of us, right? But it can seriously be taken advantage of when you're applying to grad school, because people see those dreams and they're like, we can make money. So applying to grad school is about finding a place that fits you, that's going to pay you, because you're about to do a lot of labor. Mm-hmm. And if possible, in this field, you should not go unless you're a fully funded person, or at least somewhat funded. And I understand that's a controversial statement, but I have watched so many great people get crushed in the grind and leave
and be
anthropology.
So in debt.
Leave anthropology beaten and weathered and in debt and resentful. It didn't have to happen that way. And so I always tell my students that are looking, like, interview them. And if they are worth your time and they pay you, then give them your time. Do not go groveling like they owe you an education. Those people got to, like, their whole job is to teach you.
I needed that. The listeners needed that, and I needed that statement, truly. And it's a great one. It's true. That's the truth. I don't have anything other to say than that's what it should be. Katie is speaking facts. Yeah. So let's, I guess, move on after such a powerful statement. I was looking over your CV and something just stuck out to me because I was like, wow, I've never heard about that. That's so interesting. You work as a conservation specialist using electrolytic reduction and other methods to preserve the artifacts. So I know nothing about this. So I would love if you could kind of just take us through the conservation process, whether that starts with, you know, if that includes some of the excavation, I just take us through the process. I'm excited.
Sure. There's so many facets, as we all know, to anthropological work. Doesn't matter the data set, right? We're working with human beings, and so that means there is infinite numbers of data, including in the material world. One thing I do suggest for anyone starting out is if you have an inclination towards something, like that you might feel slightly unrelated, there might be an outlet to build your set of skills and make you more diverse. And for me, my dad's a scientist and I really do like the science parts of things. And so the material that we collect as historical archaeologists is varied. But a great portion of that is metal objects. And they're often disregarded because chemically they corrode so quickly and we can't get that much information out of them. So as a young little bean, when I was working at Montpelier in Virginia, they pull out a lot of metal objects. It was a working plantation for a long time, and they had a blacksmith on site. So one of the things they had going always was electrolytic reduction. So that essentially means you're taking in this case, iron object that you find in the ground. It's been sitting in the ground for, in this case, since Dolly Madison was in her heyday, right? When it's in the ground, its chemical composition has gotten used to the soil around it, and it has been resting and slowly rotting. So the inside of metal, if you imagine its chemical structure, imagine it to be something like latticework that's very, very, very tight. And as oxygen gets in and water gets in, it starts to become more porous and fragile. So when we take our iron out of the ground as archaeologists, the first thing that happens is we change its chemical environment and it starts to go into rapid decay. So this piece of information and this object has lots of information we can get from it, but if we don't attend to its chemical environmental needs, it will deteriorate much faster than if we had never touched it. So there's pieces or objects that we decide in the field are either diagnostic or undiagnostic. They can give us information specifically about what it was, or it's just going to be a counted number. So when we find pieces of metal that could give us more information, like a furniture latch or whatever, Montpelier's choice was to do electrolytic reduction, or electrolysis. It means taking that piece of iron and putting it into a chemical solution, which is baking soda and water, very complex, and attaching an electric anode to one piece. And then you attach another anode to another piece of iron. Sometimes you use pots and pans that are retired or a piece of rebar, and then you turn on electric power. So at a very low amperage, you start sending electricity pulsing through and it creates a circuit where the chemical composition of the metal artifact starts to become stabilized first. It stops rotting. And then all the little pockets of rust inside the latticework become replaced with pockets of ions from the donation metal. I haven't explained this process in like 10 years, but you're essentially switching the ionic bonds with the piece of rebar, and it's donating its whole and like unblemished pieces into that piece of metal. So you're building the iron artifact from the inside out. And you rebuild it very slowly over time, and it can take a long time. So for example, some pieces I conserved in this process would take a month. Some would take 3 months. I think the longest we ever had anything in the tank while I was there was maybe 8 to 10 months of just slowly rebuilding this piece of metal. And then once a lot of the outside concretions have sloughed off and it's looking perky and whole again, you take it out and you do several chemical baths and you scrub it down mechanically to take off any outside corrosions. And then you seal it so that air can no longer penetrate. So it's a really cool process because it's literally rebuilding something and giving it like a second go.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I think I've seen like maybe like in a movie or at a meet, like I feel like the general process of like seeing a item in like a tank is familiar to me, but that's crazy that it actually rebuilds the metal. And also, I know you haven't said you haven't explained that in a long time, but you did a wonderful job because I have like very limited understanding of like chemistry and all that. And I was like, oh, I got it. I was like, I remember ionic bonds. Like I got it. Yeah. So that was great.
Yeah. If you have ever like the Confederate ship, the Hunley, that was in the news a few years ago, it was like the submarine that they found that's in a massive, essentially like electrolytic reduction tank. So anyone
just what like, do they attach it to give to rebuild it?
Donating metal must be
huge.
Yes, I like that. But conservation itself is like a super specific skill set, and so there's lots of other ways in which. So there's something called a compound artifact. That means an artifact with two different materials, like a bone-handled fork, or something. Or like a leather shoe with a metal stud in it. Those get very often stored wrong or improperly because archaeologists are not required to take chemistry. In a perfect world, all of us would have to take chem and o-chem.
It's hard. It's not my fault. At UCSB, they literally make it to fail the people out that don't want to be chemists.
Yeah, like, I know. I also failed O-Chem. Do not feel bad.
Oh, I didn't get anywhere near it. I can't even say I attempted. I would, no.
It's such an important skill. There's very, very, very few trained conservators, and you can get a master's degree in conservation, which is all you need. You don't need a PhD if you are into it, but you have to have graduated with your bachelor's degree with Chem and O-Chem,
mm-hmm.
1 and 2. And so very few of us make it into that world because first of all, no one knows about it, but I sort of just got like accidentally trained, which is super cool. It means I have all these weird skills about metal. Like I know that when metal comes out of the ground, first of all, human hands shouldn't touch it. Anyone listening, do better. Mm-hmm. Wear gloves. And when we take it out of the ground, if we're aware that chemical reactions are happening, we can be more cognizant of how to bag things. So all metal should be wrapped in foil because of that weird rule we learned as in high schoolers, there's noble and less noble metals. So if you find a shoe buckle and you wrap it in foil, that decaying process will stop and neutralize, and foil, which is less noble, aluminum, will donate its ions to the more noble metal, which is iron, and stop it from corroding. And so
that's so cool.
It is wildly cool. There's lots of layers to it, but it's not something most people are trained in. So I've been able to keep a few jobs or get a few jobs or things like that because I have this weird side training that makes me a little bit valuable.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said about exploiting like a niche and really, you know, being skilled in a certain area and that not a ton of people are skilled in. And I think it's always something, like you said, if you have like a side interest or like you said, side training, like you have, you know, chemistry background, definitely pursue that.
Yeah. And for me, conservation is cool because it's a actual puzzle. Right? Yeah. So some people are if you're really, really into puzzles, then maybe you're a ceramicist. Or if you, there's especially in historic archaeology, there's so many types of objects that if you can find one that you're interested in figuring out really well, then you can sort of be the go-to for that in a way that makes you more valuable. A lot of people are jacks of all trades, and that's wonderful. I am as well. But if you are into one sort of thing, hone it. Use it. Get paid for it.
Definitely. Also, sorry, I keep muting myself. The garbage truck has been like just chilling around for the last 5 minutes, but I think he finally drove away. So just in time. I was like, so loud. That is one thing about my new apartment. I moved. It's not quite as quiet as the old one because I'm on the bottom floor, but you know, it's okay. I always tell people, I'm like, this is a college student making a very low budget podcast. Like if you expect anything more than that, like I just wouldn't go in with like expecting any perfect audio.
know what you're getting into. And
let me see, where do I, okay, let's, so I know for you, you've kind of touched on how important, you know, creating ethical, sustainable, community-driven elements are to your projects and including like, you know, working with indigenous groups. I'm really curious, like how in your more recent projects, you're applying that and you're, you know, creating those opportunities in ways you weren't able to before. And I know, you know, you're working on that at the, I don't know why I don't have it written down. The site, the historic Mitchellville Freedom Park.
Yeah. So one of the important parts to know for anybody who's slightly behind me in this trajectory is literally nothing's predictable, and you just have to let that go and plan that you'll never know where you're going to end up. I did not plan to be working on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been here, there's too much traffic for me. but when I was in Binghamton, there was no Southeasternists. I went there to work with Siobhan Hart. Also, she teaches at Skidmore. If you want to learn how to do public archaeology, work with her. But a professor named Matt Sanger, he was freshly out of school. He started working there, and he is a Southeasternist. And so I had a lot more field time than a lot of the other graduate students, and it just sort of made sense for me to go with him on a field project because I also was a Southeasternist. So we just started working together in a way because it made sense. On Hilton Head, he works on ancient shell rings. And so we went on our first project, and it turned out we worked really well together. He was very chill, and I'm very high strung. And so it was like a nice medium there. We worked at the Sepan shell ring for many years, but my master's degree is about a site in New York. It has nothing to do with this because I was working with Siobhan. And then Siobhan decided she was going to go to Skidmore, which is fantastic for her. So I needed a new professor as my advisor. And so Matt took me on, and my work on Hilton Head has really blossomed in a way that is unpredictable. I was here with undergraduates in like 2017, and I was invited to the Juneteenth celebration at Historic Mitchell Freedom Park, which is on the other side of the island. And Mitchellville was the first free Black town in the American South. Its citizens were Black and free before the Emancipation Proclamation happened, which is a big deal. Mm-hmm.
And how many years ago was it that you went to this celebration? Just because now Juneteenth, you know, is an actual like national holiday. So I just want to clarify to people that this was before that.
Yes, it would have been the summer of 2017. Okay. So I don't want to think about how many years ago that is now.
That's fine.
Yeah. So I went, and it was a very small scale but cool celebration. And I met a bunch of islanders I had not met before, and folks that worked for this nonprofit organization. And it's a Black run organization that is, at the time, was slated to preserve and promote the heritage of Mitchellville. And while I was at Juneteenth, I met another archaeologist there, Dr. Cheryl LaRoche, who is an incredible archaeologist. just happened to be there, and she started asking me questions about why I liked archaeology and what I was into. And I realized now she was sort of interviewing me. I told them I'd worked at Montpelier, and she knew Matt Reeves, the man who runs that. And she just sort of was like, we need an archaeologist here, and you care about social justice. Would you mind doing a small project? And so I did one tiny little project, and it was like literally 3 days of remote sensing. And then we obviously needed more than that. So they had hired a new director like that month or something. And so I went back the next year as another sort of favor, and did another remote sensing project, helping try to find their first church or praise house. And then after that, they were sort of like, do you, like, this could be your dissertation. Mm-hmm. Do you not want to do that? Do you want to do that? Like, what's the deal here? Because I had been planning to write my dissertation about the Sepan shell ring, which is like a 4,000-year-old ancient indigenous site, right? Very different than a site from 1865, essentially. And I have been running my mouth about community-based projects for like all of time. I got in trouble at 10 for mouthing off to my dad's boss about how he was not invested in the community. So when this community project happened, there was no way I couldn't say yes to that, especially because it was a community who wanted an archaeology done with and for them. Mm-hmm. And that's what community archaeology is about. It's what indigenous archaeology is about. And so I was like hesitant, because it's very scary to be responsible for that sort of thing. But I went for it. So I've been working with Historic Mitchellville since 2017, but I started basically, this is my full-time project. It would be the spring of 2018. And since then I've run 7 major projects in the park. Most of them have been reconnaissance, sort of like large scale surveys. Some of them have been excavations, but all of them have been community driven. Mm-hmm. In like a super foundational way. A lot of people say that, but just so everyone here knows, I don't care about the Civil War history. I mean, it's cool. It's not that I don't care about it. It's just like, that is not what I started out.
Yeah.
Right. And I also don't care much about like what 19th century praise houses and churches are shaped like. Beach archaeology sucks. But I had to decide that what I'm interested in is like cool, but not important. What needed to happen is that I have tools, and tools that I worked hard for, mm-hmm. and I'm good at. And I had to take that toolbox, open it up, and say, here's what I can do for you. Where are we driving this bus? So I've been very lucky, because I work with my boss, Director Maud Ward, is the same way. And he's sort of like, this project is about Native Islanders, Gullah folks. And it's about preserving and promoting this heritage that's way beyond me. So let's just do a series of very intensive community outreach meetings. And I just have to, everything I do is filtered through that lens. So it changes how you do archaeology. It's not about really the results as fundamentally as it is about the process.
Do you find that it has affected other aspects of your life, in that I could be completely off focus, but you're putting, you know, so much through that lens that like, I could definitely see like for environmental impacts or just other big issues in the world, like, do you find yourself kind of applying that same, like, I'm doing it for other people, using my skill set to help the world, you know? I think lots of times, like, we hear, you know, I think anthropology is going to help solve the world's huge crises right now, you know? And I'm curious, do you feel like that mindset is applying to other aspects of your life?
Yes, I think I think I'm a weirdo in some ways in that, real talk, like between trauma and where I grew up and who my family is, I've always been very focused on others and not myself. And mm-hmm. that manifests in both beautiful and terrible ways, right? So this is sort of like a branch out of my normal book in service. I do feel like, and I am very comfortable feeling like my work is in service of mm-hmm. a greater good. And I think that's very contrary to what most academic and traditional academic programs are about. That's changing, obviously, but especially when you look into the tenets of Indigenous archaeology, Indigenous women put their foot down. And, you know, in the 90s, we're like, we're doing this differently. Archaeology is by, with, and for communities, Indigenous communities, stakeholder communities, because Indigenous ways of knowing the world are relational. Mm-hmm. It's about how you are related to yourself and everyone around you. And what does that mean when you live? How does your impact affect everyone else? And I find that to be not just important, but vital and beautiful. We're part of an ecosystem that reaches far beyond our own understanding. And that's essential to my life.
Yeah. You've found your place in that ecosystem. You found your role in the ecosystem.
And working at Mitchellville is like getting to be fully myself, because I get to have like the most radical non-traditional ideas and people are like, let's do it.
That's
just
great.
Stuff that normally I would be not able to do. And I've been lucky to have been working with them, because I've gotten a lot of grant money to do things that are just not normal. But my outlook has been changed many times, especially working with this incredible Mitchellville group. The Mitchell family is people who have like made me think about not just my impact, but my own like health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Because I work with these people as a community.
Yeah.
I'm not just a contractor for them. I get to be a person, which is really cool, because a lot of times when we're anthropologists and we're working as a contractor, we don't get to be people, we get to be a service.
Yeah.
And so working with this community, these communities, means that there's people who check on me. And when I'm having a really hard time with something, I tell my community members and I say, I'm just struggling writing this and I don't know what to say. And they will help me.
Or that's incredible.
Try to, yeah, you know, it's an incredible thing to have people want you to succeed because you want them to succeed and you're working in concert. Mm-hmm. And that, I didn't expect that, right, at all. I came into this with like a very weird, like, I'm a community archaeologist and I will do this in service and then I will go and it'll be like this own thing on its own trajectory. And by decentralizing my power as a professional and taking away myself as like important in my own mind, I was like, my things are not important.
Yeah.
Because this story is important. The community members I work with said, that's very untrue. You're incredibly important and you're very loved and you've done a wonderful job. And when you're having a bad day, we will help you figure it out. Like,
so heartwarming.
What? That's crazy. Yeah. And unexpected. Yeah. Like when I'm having a hard time, sometimes they bring me dinner. Oh my God. Yeah.
So amazing.
I understand that I'm lucky and that's not going to happen to everyone, but I want to make sure that the point gets across that I decentered myself because that's what's needed for radical change. Radical empathy, to understand that you are part, a cog in a wheel. And mm-hmm. then if you can do that in a way that's genuine, I really believe that it can pay out. In, it took a long time, but the community, I dumped my resources and my unselfish parts into, and sometimes selfish, like it was very selfish, some choices where I was like, I really want to be a cool archaeologist. But they see that I'm genuine and they see that I'm going to make mistakes. But if they tell me I'm making mistakes, that I'll change it.
Yeah.
And they see that I'm not, you know, proprietary with anything. And that makes them trust that I will always have their best interests. And so they now have my best interest at heart. That's pretty cool.
It's incredible. It's so special. And I was looking at, you know, your website and a lot of the photos that you have up with the team and with people. And I just, you know for me working during COVID, because, you know, I was reading that, you know, some of that field work and the remote sensing was going on, you know, amidst the pandemic, I had a field work project that was going on as well. And really, like, that camaraderie and, like, being able to sit in the dirt with, like, a couple people and just, like, talk and, like, have, you know, their support in the project was so vital in getting through COVID and not having, like, a lot of, you know, especially, like, we were so locked down here in California, like, not having a lot of contact even with, like, my mom, who doesn't live that far, you know, having my teammates was super great. And so I was curious, that probably ties in for you during COVID. Was it extra helpful to have kind of that support system and have field work going on? Because, you know, not everyone was lucky enough to have field work going on during COVID. It was extenuating circumstances. Ours was, you know, a disaster recovery circumstance. So, you know, we were lucky in that way. But yeah, sorry, go ahead and answer that.
I think, yes, definitely. So some of COVID was really, really scary and hard being in the field, because it's like, you know, how many different instructions and how many different ways of interpreting or knowing the directions that we were supposed to be under did we have, right? So at every crossroad, things got worse and it was scarier. Mm-hmm. Because I was the boss of things, people's health and their well-being becomes my concern, because I am in charge of what they have to do at work. Mm-hmm. So it was incredibly stressful, like took a real toll on me when we did field work in November, December, and January. And that was peak in North Carolina. And we're on a vacation island. And so a bunch of like twerps who wanted to escape wherever they were came to Hilton Head for the winter and were getting people sick. So I was so protective of my team, because I would take no chances, which was hard. And I was so nervous about them. But my philosophy at work is that everyone, I have this principle in my mind, I call it the A-team, which is not original, obviously, but I believe that each person has skills that should be acknowledged and boosted, right? So if you come in and you're good at math, and you want to do math, it's how you do math. I'm extremely dyslexic, and numbers aren't super great for me. Yeah. So if I have a person who's good at mapping, like, you're going to map, baby. If you have skills as like a person who, like, one of my crew members had really, really intense ADHD and loved small menial tasks that were just like comforting in some level, like, let's take that, harness it. If you have, you know, a propensity for speaking and talking and chatting, then you probably are going to be a really good public archaeology representative. And so the space that my team functions in, hopefully and usually, gets to be really tight, because no one's getting crushed by work that makes them feel like they're not valuable. Mm-hmm. Like interpersonal stuff, especially in the field, that's a whole nother thing. COVID on top of it, right? Mm-hmm. But at work, I want the people that I work with to know their value, because I definitely did not get that as a field tech. And I worked in this industry also when sexual harassment was like the fun thing to do at work. So I try to create an environment of safety and value. That means my team and I get to feel safety and value from each other. And I like still have active group chats of most of the crews I've had, because it's not even so much liking each other. Sometimes there's huge rifts in the team,
yeah.
But there is value for most of us. that's really important. And so during COVID, like coming to work and having this team, these five mm-hmm. people that worked with me this last survey, probably the best team I'll ever be on. I mean, they were a mess some days because it was COVID and they might have been drinking a little bit, but their skills were incredible. And they just, mm-hmm. it just made me feel so much better about what was happening, because I knew that even though like there was a literal coup happening at the Capitol and everything else was drenched in plague, me and my team were still doing important work and we were doing it well and we cared about it. Mm-hmm. And so it was 100% a gift during massive lockdown. Like that project spanned a presidential election, peak COVID, Capitol being run over by, you know, terrorists, more peak COVID. Like it was a crazy time.
Yes. Not to just like our project ran from September until like this June. We just turned the forensic report in like last week, so to this July. So it has been through the most hectic, you know, like craziness. And I just completely agree that it was so much was going on and we're doing such impactful work. Like it's literally disaster, forensic, human remains recovery amidst a pandemic for a grieving mother. Like, you know, there's so many more layers beyond just what you're doing. There's then so the team and having that support is so, so imperative. And an environment you can be really be comfortable in, because we were very comfortable. And I remember the day that we all showed up and we could, because we're all vaccinated and we could finally not wear our masks when we were excavating, and we were like, this is so great. I can see your smile. Like, it's just so nice. So.
Yeah, it was a lovely, like we had all, we essentially did like a baby bubble. We had all quarantined for 2 weeks and then the team lived together. So they had to be bubbled with each other, which was great in some circumstances because we could be unmasked with each other. Mm-hmm. We had all quarantined and then every time we would leave the quarantine, people had to get tested to come back in. Which compared to a lot of the other firms that were working in the Southeast, like that is an extreme measure that most people weren't taking at that
point. Yeah, no, that is.
And a lot of people were.
But I'm sure you had a lot of success from taking such extreme measures.
Yes, no illness, which was amazing. It is kind of crazy because there was such high numbers here and, you know, they're still going to the grocery store and visitors were still walking up to us without a mask, mm-hmm. you know, getting in my face about stuff. So it was really like nutrient heavy getting to like hang out with these people that I respected and valued, and be humans with them where everything else was just the 13th century.
Yep, definitely. I think this is maybe a good time to bring up, you know, what you think are good key conditions or field work experiences for like CRM or just like general field work. Obviously CRM would be a career for someone versus maybe someone just going on a field project. But like we were saying, I think it's really important to like stick up for the good conditions and the respect you know that you deserve in field work. I realized that from my first field school on to now that you can actually, you know, you can demand respect for yourself in the conditions that you should have to work in. So I'm curious to hear kind of what you would maybe advise people as good keys or maybe things to look out for or thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think it changes every year in some aspects. So first of all, the CRM world is the biggest part of archaeology. Hands down, and especially American archaeology. I don't know the mm-hmm. percent anymore, but it used to be like 80% of archaeology done in the United States is cultural resource management. So there's that. It means that if you want to be an archaeologist, the chances of being a professor of archaeology are narrower every single day. And it's just a reality. Mm-hmm. And let me just tell you, any person interested in that, it sounds great, but it's really awful in a lot of aspects, right? There's things that you don't really see until you get to the higher levels and you're like, these people work nonstop.
Academia is so flawed.
Really, they're 10-year track, that 3-year to 5-year 10-year track gauntlet is terrifying. And then you get in, and if your department isn't full of people that you want to work with, it can be a living hell. So although it's cool to be able to do field work 3 months of year, CRM is actually a great alternative. And so I want to just make sure that people understand that it's a really cool world. And if we have a massive infrastructure bill go in that President Biden is currently talking about, that could be a huge, big deal for archaeologists. Mm-hmm. The last time archaeology got such a big boop was when, you know, like in the 60s and 70s, when the infrastructure for the United States was happening. That's why archaeology does exist as a career, because everything that got built needed archaeology.
Yeah.
After, you know, like Section 106 was passed. So we could be coming into a time where there's even more jobs.
Mm-hmm.
On that note, as an individual, it's a rough path sometimes. There's still people paying very low wages. And that's, especially if it's a small company, it's because they're trying to compete with larger companies that can put in a higher or a lower bid. So as a field tech, you're normally a subcontractor, right? You're hired on a contract, a 1099, to a person who's also a contract to some other company, oil company, DOT, construction company. That means there's no health insurance usually, there's frequent travel, and potentially low wages. So I think it is very vital, if you are an archaeologist, to work in CRM, even if it's for 2 or 3 years. If you want to go to grad school, that's fine, but you do need to have some field time, especially because you have to know what you're doing if you are the boss and you leave later. Like, you got to be able to drive your truck through a bog. And you can't do that if you never went to the field.
Yeah.
But I'm a person who, I'm a woman person. And so it's very difficult in many aspects, and still is. I don't care what anybody says, especially if you work in a place like the Southeast, like me, we have to go in advocating for ourselves. And I think people that are younger than me, you guys are my hopes and dreams. You are much better at boundary setting than I ever could be. I'm still working at it, but flex that skill. You're right. There is a very serious need for people to put their foot down and not accept things that are unacceptable. So I definitely worked for wages lower than I probably should have, but I also endured things at work that I never should have. You know, like I don't know how many times people slap my ass at work, but it is definitely more than I can count.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely. That's not so much a thing now, but that does not mean there's not other circumstances equally as obnoxious or damaging.
Yeah.
On a personal level or on a professional level. If you, as a field tech, feel like your rights are being violated, it's very important to stand up for that. So I think...
And it's important too, I think, to say too, that it doesn't have to be a physical action. You know, it could be, you know,
it could be
verbal or whatever.
Some person, like, for example, could be a crew chief that laughs it off when you say that somebody else is being gross
or
unacceptable. I think it's very scary sometimes to older field directors or crew chiefs when younger people say things like, somebody is disrespecting my space, because they might not have the tools to understand that. That's okay. That's not your job to teach them. But you can say, someone is disrespecting my space, and it's very important that this is a professional place for me. Archaeology can get very unprofessional very quickly because it's the field. But younger archaeologists need to maintain their boundaries and say, this is my profession, and I'm at work. And so while I am at work, these are my work boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's hard because we live together and we're on the road and you're in like some poopy Days Inn in Conrad, Arkansas. And the only people you know are the four people you work with. So lines can get very blurred. So my advice would to be to make sure that you protect your own environment until you can get to a place where you're the person defining the environment. So you decide your level of professionalism that's acceptable for you, and you maintain it.
And your level of interpersonal sharing or, you know, disclosure, whatever you're comfortable with.
And if it gets hard and blurry, think, if I was a dental hygienist, would this be acceptable? Make that your rule. And then if it's not, it's not. And then at some point you'll be in charge and you can say, it's really fun to joke, guys. And I love to tease and have fun, but there will be no sexual harassment. There will be no fat shaming. There will be no racist remarks. There will be not a space in which we shame anybody for their gender or their sexual orientation, because it's very possible to have fun and not be cruel. And we won't do that here. That doesn't happen everywhere.
No, it does not.
But if you can maintain your boundaries long enough, you can be the person that makes them.
Yes.
And more people like that.
Mm-hmm. That's the first thing I said to everyone when they stepped on our project in Montecito, because while I was by no means running it, it was a student-led team. So we were kind of all supporting each other. And I said, this is a very small scale field project in a in a town 20 minutes from where we live. But remember that these conditions where you're allowed to talk to each other, where you're allowed to laugh and enjoy conversation. Because my first field school, archaeologists don't talk while they're working. They work in the quiet and they sit there and they excavate bones. And, you know, yeah, and you don't get breaks and you can't be yourself. And it's like, no. There are little, even just little things like that. You can be professional and still, you know, care about your team members and have conversation that's passes the long time of moving dirt.
Yeah. The other small, like very technical piece of advice is wage stuff. So be very vocal about how much you make and ask questions about it. And it's uncomfortable for a little bit, get used to it if you can, but you should know what you make on a crew. So say you're making $15.50 and someone else around you is making $16.50. It's important that you know that and you know why. Because if it's based on experience, that's fine. If it's based on things like perceived gender, that's not. Yeah. And I worked on crews that was true. But the other thing is, when you are job hunting, you have every right to ask.
And negotiate.
And furthermore, you're a subcontractor. So if you're getting paid $16 an hour, it's very likely that the contract your company negotiated at is like they negotiated to get $100 an hour for you. And some of that goes to overhead, and some of that goes to per diem, and some of that goes to profit. And so you can ask what they are making per your hourly.
Mm.
That's an okay question.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a disparity. There should be, because that's how companies work, right? But if you do it enough times, you will be able to, because I don't know what region anyone's in or what country.
Yeah.
If you do it enough times, you should be able to start gauging how much companies around you charge the people they work for you an hour. Write it down, keep it down. And then you should be able to like figure out an average and be like, okay, so typically people bill for like $100 an hour per me, but I'm making $12.50. So their profit margin is too high and they're abusing me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good way to be able to gauge when someone's offering you a job, if you want to work for them, because it really reflects on their ethical stance.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So that's a piece of like technical advice.
No, I think that's extremely valuable advice. I think this whole episode has been full of really great information. And I'm also just really thankful that I got to chat with you, you know, just for our listeners. This was an Amy recommendation. Amy was like, so basically you have to have Katie on the podcast if you have time. And I can completely understand why. How did y'all meet? I can cut it out too if you don't want it in the podcast. I'm just generally curious.
Such a good story. It is such a good story. Oh my God. Okay. So my.
Oh no, you froze right when you started speaking.
And he got into Southern Mississippi as a grad school. So I was like, all right, I guess I'm moving and I'll find a job when I get there. And I found a job doing CRM, working in Meridian, Mississippi. And Amy and I got hired on the same day, and she had just left undergrad and she had just come out of her first field school. So I'd been working as a professional archaeologist for like a year, but not in CRM. So we walked onto a site, and this was like the most berserk, insane project. It was in rural Mississippi, and it was a huge excavation for American coal. And the company was cheap, so they didn't want to pay to drive us in every single day because it would be like an hour and a half drive. And we were so far back, there wasn't a road, and they didn't want to have to like bus us in and then have us hike for a mile. So instead, mm-hmm. it was a camping job.
Mm.
And it was supposed to be like 3 months, but I camped from September to April. And some people went from like June to June.
Mm-hmm.
And so Amy and I, when we first got started, we were together, and I just remember being like, oh my God, she doesn't know what she's doing. I have to help this girl. She had been trained doing like real archaeology, and this was just brutal. I mean, it was September in Mississippi, and the clay was baked to terracotta status. And so I gave her some tips on digging because I've been in the South for a little bit, and we survived this like horrific project where we camped for an entire winter and spring in hurricane and mud Dang. And rain, and it was 30 degrees for some of it. We built our own shelter because our tents disintegrated, and so I lived in a makeshift wigwam with Amy for like months. Made out of.
I'm glad I asked. I'm so glad I asked how you guys met. This is amazing.
It was like saplings and tarps, and I'm really proud of it because it had a floor and we could take our shoes off. But yeah, we survived one of the most insane things I'll ever do. We literally camped together
mm-hmm.
for months and months and months and months of our lives. And Amy is an incredible person and yes. still my best friend, and I see her like on Zoom every single day, oh. which is crazy because that was 2012. So we made a life bond, shivering in our very smelly, we hadn't showered in 13 days
yeah.
Carhartts in Kemper County, Mississippi.
Yeah, sometimes field work is not glamorous. It's never glamorous, but like sometimes it's like really, 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 really not.
Yeah, that's the project that I learned that I could shampoo my hair once a week and be okay because yeah. that's what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Now it's the trend. Now it's like everyone says that's better for your hair. That's like what yeah. you're supposed to do now.
That was a crazy, actually, that's so funny because it was crazy. It was like people started doing the no poo thing, and I was like, oh my God, well that saves me because I'm a grub right now. It was a liberating thing, actually. A lot mm-hmm. of it was liberating in that there was no mirrors, and I was yeah. camping with 35 other people, and we were all sort of feral, but I realized that I didn't have to try.
Mm-hmm.
People still treated me like I was a person, even though I wasn't dealing with my hair or my face. And it was also horrible. I mean, sharing a port-a-john in the middle of the wilderness with 35 other people for a lot of months. Yeah, learned a lot about the human GI, but that is how I met Amy. And I've worked on like a bunch of projects since then with her. We did CRM together for a few years. She might kill me, but we definitely like worked on a goat farm together for a while.
You worked on the farm with her. I was going to say, I just like all the whole time you were speaking, I was like, I don't know why, I just have this image that she put like in her osteology lecture of her on the farm. And I was just thinking about Amy on the farm.
Yeah, that was us. I probably took that picture. So yeah.
That's great.
That, we've gotten to have all these years together being super weird. Mm-hmm. And odd.
Yes, it's amazing. You meet lots of great people in, you know, anthropology and in the field. And it's a really special thing. People that like you that are from all over, you know, I think that's a really unique, you know, obviously in your department, you're going to meet, you know, your classmates, but when you're on a field project or you're on a big project, you know, there can be people from different universities and from different countries. So you're really meeting people that you maybe wouldn't run into normally.
Oh, for sure. And because it's like a weird, it's like being deployed. It's a very special situation. You get transported to this place that you've never been. You work all day with a group of people and then you spend all night with a group of people. And sometimes that's horrible, but sometimes it's like accelerated friendship. So you get like a huge life bond. There's people that I have seen for years. Like, for example, last summer I worked with two guys that I hadn't worked with in 6 years, and it was incredible. We were still friends. We still had like this really fun bond because we were like field siblings. And there's, I got a lot of people out there that I've got to work with that are just like my lifers, my friends that, you know, I sat in some terrible hole with for lots of months of my life.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. And I'm sure, you know, our listeners really appreciate it. We'll have everything for Katie linked below, you know, her website, some publications. I don't know if you want to share your social media, but we can link that as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. My Twitter is super good to share. It's just CBGBs. There's like a lot of anti-colonial and racial justice stuff there. So if that's your thing, head over. But this was really fun and I'm very impressed by your whole thing here. You got a lot of cool stuff going on. Thank you.
Thank you.